Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. There's a big difference between a solution that measures a fundraiser's performance and a solution that helps a fundraiser perform. QBAC helps fundraisers to excel at their most critical task, developing deep, meaningful relationships with donors and cultivating them into lifelong givers. Give your fundraisers a better qualified portfolio, one that considers more than just capacity and simple scoring. Your fundraisers will also get insights into the hearts, minds, and connections of their donors. Fundraisers have a tough job. Help them close bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Podcast listeners, the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow is finally back on the schedule. We have several dates confirmed. Since 2014, our team has been providing high-quality one-day roadshows in partnership with nonprofit leaders who want to showcase their space and provide thought-provoking and highly interactive fundraising training in their nonprofit community. Our roadshows have been described by our guest as hands down the best professional development experience that they have ever been a part of. This experience has been described as challenging assumptions with conversation-inspiring content and new ways of thinking. If you would like to register for one of the upcoming stops on the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow, just visit the link in the show notes. Hi, Madge. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You're the Executive Director at Mission Capital in Austin, and you're hosting our event, the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow, here in a couple of weeks. And I'm just delighted that Marie and Michelle grabbed your attention and said, hey, hop on the podcast here with Jason for a little while so that you and I could get to know each other. So I'm really delighted that we're on here to have a brief conversation. Madge, before we dive into our topic of conversation, how about I just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. Thank you, Jason. It's great to spend the afternoon with you. Yes, I'm Madge Vasquez. I have the privilege of leading Mission Capital, which is a nonprofit based in Austin, Texas, that is a nonprofit capacity builder and consultant. We're also a membership organization that really serves the nonprofit ecosystem here in Austin. So I like to say, we're the guide on the side for our nonprofit organizations as they are experiencing leadership transitions and inviting their next leader to lead, as they are thinking about strategic planning and revenue modeling to help them be stronger. We also do collective impact. So we will be the convener that comes and brings together a coalition of nonprofits around a common issue. And so we backbone collective impact initiative. So it is a delight to be with y'all this afternoon to talk about what's on every, nonprofit ED CEO's mind, and that's fundraising, how to garner resources for to fuel our mission.
Yeah, Madge. So when Michelle reached out to me, I don't know, that was probably a good month or two ago, and she said, "Hey, why don't you kick off your roadshow schedule in Austin, in a town like Austin? That's already sort of pretty high on the list. Yeah, that's a great town to do that." But then when she said Mission Capital's interested in doing that, I spent I had to have spent probably 45 minutes going all over your website, getting to know your people. I was like, okay, this is a winner. I couldn't have been more excited. So I spent a lot of time on your website. Madge, before we dive into our topic of conversation, can you just, you're not a startup your organization's been around a while. Would you mind just sort of telling what's sort of the story behind the organization?
Yeah, great question, Jason. We're delighted that we just celebrated our 20th anniversary last year. So we're now 21 as a nonprofit organization.
You're an adult now, right?
We are. We're an adult. That's right. We were going off to college. We were started by what I love to fondly call a group of godmothers in the community who they were community volunteers, board members of different nonprofits. And they had identified a gap, which was, you know, just having a nonprofit hub that would serve nonprofits and help them be more effective, resilient, and sustainable over time. And so that's how we were created. And there are other groups like us across the country, like Mission Capital, but each independent, who provide that kind of nonprofit management support and leadership support to our region's nonprofits.
And you haven't, how long have you been there, and why does this resonate? Connect, if you don't mind, connect your story with their story for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I have been serving as CEO of Mission Capital now coming up on 5 years.
Okay.
And I'm the third CEO in the organization's history. I am the first woman of color to lead Mission Capital. We had our founder, Deborah Edwards. We had my predecessor, Matt Curry, who served almost a decade, really scaling our nonprofit work on the consulting side and some of the collective impact side. And in 2018, as the board was getting ready to invite its next and third CEO, the board and staff were at a moment in our organizational life where they felt that equity was important. I don't think any of us really knew what that meant at that time. And this was pre-George Floyd, pre-Breonna Taylor, pre-national racial reckoning in the world and in the United States. And I heard that kind of mission commitment and aspiration really clearly when I was interviewing at Mission Capital. And I felt, having been a nonprofit professional and having worked in the private sector as well, having worked in private sector consulting and banking, and then spending a lot of my time in the nonprofit sector, both as staff and a board member, I felt like that commitment really resonated with me. And so I joined Mission Capital in January of 2018. We set a bold racial equity vision. And again, this was before, the social sector and philanthropy had decided to be really supported and explicit about racial equity. So we were a couple years ahead of that, and started really thinking about, what does that mean for our work? What does it mean for us to show up in a way that centers racial equity in a community like Austin, Texas, and in a state like Texas? And so fast forward to now, we've been really supporting our nonprofits through this pandemic moment, right? I like to say the not quite post-pandemic moment, where all of us are really leaning into this opportunity to take care and support our communities in a way that acknowledges that our communities possess the solutions, right? There's a shift from kind of the traditional charity to solidarity that we've been trying to usher in as an organization supporting nonprofits, acknowledging we don't have all of the answers, but we're here to support shoulder to shoulder with our nonprofit organizations and the communities and constituents that they serve.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to be, or let me say this, or pose it as a question. It has to be an interesting time to be in the state of Texas, watching with the midterms coming up, with the upcoming elections, with the governor's race, with some of the tragedies that you've recently encountered. I've had some of these conversations very briefly with Michelle. It's an interesting time to be in Texas. Am I right?
It is. It certainly is. Yes. And that's why our focus at Mission Capital is really timely. And so, as I was sharing, under our kind of strategic vision and mission, you know, we set three explicit goals. The first one was to close the racial leadership gap in our social sector.
Yeah.
And the second one is to increase organizational resilience and sustainability of the sector. And the third is to really expand collaborative networks, kind of like what we're doing with you and your group today. You know, when we think about that first goal of closing the racial leadership gap, we partnered with a national group called the Building Movement Project. And they do a series of studies on what's the state of the union of the nonprofit sector? You know, what do those executive ranks look like?
Yes.
And yeah, so we partnered with them to help us study, like, what does Austin, Central Texas, look like? And lo and behold, it looks very much like the rest of the country. And the data says that less than 20% of our region's nonprofits are led by people of color, though the vast majority of our nonprofits serve communities of color. And so there's that disconnect there, right, in representation and lived experience and really relationship, deep relationship with community. So we took that study, the data, and thought about how can we help activate those data findings in a solution-oriented way. What we know is that there are plenty of qualified and able and ready leaders of color who are ready to lead nonprofits.
Yeah.
What we know from the data is that there are barriers to entry of leadership because those boards and search committees may not reflect the communities that they serve and may not have those connections with those leaders. We also know that the data says that BIPOC-led nonprofits are woefully undercapitalized. They don't have the same access to philanthropy and donor networks. And then third, we also know the data says that they might not have the same access to mentorship opportunities, and our networks are a little bit smaller. And I say that as a woman of color, a Latina, fifth generation Mexican American Texan here, living and working in Central Texas. And so we really, you know, activated those data findings and used it to co-design and co-create some programmatic offerings specifically for BIPOC CEOs and executive directors so that we could come together and support one another and solution together. And so we've been doing that now for the last about year and a half, and it's been a really beautiful community gift to be able to support those leaders.
We've had some interesting conversations on the podcast recently. I can think of several that sort of swung. Basically, we were sort of posing the question of women and people of color assuming leadership roles, and then what does a white guy like me? What does a fella like me? What's the role that I play? And I, you know, Madge, one of the things that someone said to me recently, which really got me thinking, which is why collaborations like this get me really excited, wasn't this idea of me just completely getting out of the way. It wasn't the idea of me just sort of abandoning the table. But there were some, and I'm blending probably a number of thoughts together, but I'm curious, if I'm the average white guy who's privileged with a number of contacts in a city like Austin, what am I doing at Mission Capital? Mm-hmm. What are you saying to me if I knock on the door tomorrow?
I'm recruiting you.
Yeah, and I appreciate
it. Exactly.
That.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking to help us, right, in our mission. It really does take all of us. And yeah. And that's actually, yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned this, Jason, because that's one of the, you know, the threads of work that I feel is really important that we don't often talk about, and that's the power of allyship.
Right,
and so,
right.
You know, it's really important for white folks, professionals, donors, board members, staff to think about their own racial equity muscles and their own journey, and acknowledging and courageously, you know, calling in moments when white dominant culture may not be serving us and may not be benefiting the community, and really modeling that in a powerful way. And so I actually believe that, you know, in the fundraising space, that fundraisers have an incredible opportunity to really flex that allyship, you know, with their executives, with their boards, with their donors.
Yeah, we've had a number of women of color in particular been guests on the podcast, and they have really helped me as a guy who's genuinely trying to sort of always trying to figure out my place in the world, I guess you might say, you know, trying to sort of figure out where I, you know, with somebody who has a platform and has influence and has friends, You know, what do I do? And obviously, as you can imagine, this collaboration with you and with Michelle and others is certainly it's an affirmation of perhaps I'm learning some of the stuff I'm supposed to be learning. Madge, we ask our guests to come on here with a big idea or bold opinion. I always sit back and say, okay, what do you want to talk about? Sometimes I know what we're going to talk about. Sometimes I don't, but we let you take the conversation any direction you'd like to. What do you got for us today?
Yes. Well, based on the mission that I've just described at Mission Capital, I think my the big idea or the bold question is more of a curious question. And that is, what if our philanthropic institutions, our corporate foundations, our fundraising professionals, donors, and nonprofit EDs reflected the communities we serve? What would that look like? And what would it feel like? How would the world be different?
Yeah. So, Madge, I teach a class over the local college. I teach two sections of our nonprofit management course in the spring. So I just finished, and I'll be asking that same question here in our community here in Central Pennsylvania. That's one of those questions that we've asked the students. You know, I'll have 30 or 40 students in one of those sections, and we wrestle with what is that? What if the organization, in its various different forms, actually looked like who it served? So what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it would be really powerful. And I think it would be inclusive. That's the other part. I think there has been kind of a legacy conversation of, and you just brought it up too, of the us versus them, right? It's either you're white or BIPOC. And what we haven't spent enough time working on and talking about is this importance of inclusion and belonging. And that is a daily practice and invitation to recognize each person and their racial identities, everything that they bring to the table, their lived experience, and think about how together, you know, we can build this really inclusive and powerful group of advocates and professionals in the sector. And so that's something that we at Mission Capital have been talking about for a long time. And again, trying to practice ourselves, if that makes sense.
I had a guest on here talking about a sort of a similar vein of conversation. And there were a couple of points in the conversation where I felt like where I felt like we didn't have an answer to this question. Like we had not perhaps explored this enough, and we didn't have enough, you know, the sector hadn't had enough success. We didn't have enough case studies, I guess, is what I'm saying. We didn't have enough examples of where we've answered that question in a positive, affirmative way. What does this look like? What is an organization that truly serves the community? What is, in your mind, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm just thinking of some of our clients that we serve and folks who have gone through some really incredible transformations. And I think about our organization at Mission Capital as well, and how we've worked really hard and continue to learn and unlearn, as we like to say. But for example, like if I just took Mission Capital as a case study, you know, when we shortly after joining the organization, after we set our explicit strategy around racial equity, we had some internal goals around where we wanted to shift. You know, at that time, I came into the organization with a predominantly white board. If we fast forward to today, almost four and a half years later, that board is now majority BIPOC. And so we have lots of different voices and representatives. The same thing in terms of our staff. You know, at the time, it was a predominantly white staff, predominantly white executive or leadership team that was reporting to the CEO. And again, over time, you know, and then the pandemic happened and, you know, there were shifts and changes, but we now have a BIPOC majority leadership team of women of color. And it doesn't say we're all women of color. We have white representation, and it's just more blended now. And we're able to hold space and have different conversations around what's happening in our community, bringing that lived experience as an offering, right? And to help support our sector. And so that's just kind of a very demographic representation, but it's very tangible as well. What that shift has also done is model that these structural shifts are possible for our clients as well. And so as I, you know, started out the podcast sharing, shortly after George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor, like all of the national racial reckoning, you know, we started seeing corporations, foundations, nonprofits all issue very powerful equity statements. Mm-hmm. What we haven't seen as much of is how those statements have actually been operationalized into action in their organization. So that really is that next step. And that's what Mission Capital is here to do as well, to help folks kind of think through strategy and how do we help our organizations develop the equity understanding, language, muscle to do the work differently.
One of the conversations we've had here on the podcast a couple of times when it comes to operationalizing some of these, what I routinely refer to as sort of these higher aspirations. I think there's been a lot of the outcomes of the last couple of years since since the pandemic and everything that has transpired in our world since then, these higher aspirations. But when it comes to operationalizing, just the simple aspiration of wanting to have a more diverse donor pool. Are you familiar? Because that's got to be in the mix, right? You want a more, you know, I remember when I was, Madge, when I was working, and I've shared these stories before with my other guest, when I was at the Epilepsy Foundation in Washington, I had a wonderful time working for Danielle. Danielle was a woman of color. We traveled the country and we learned all those dynamics of me being a junior employee and her being a leader, her being a woman and her being a Black woman. We navigated all of that. But one of the things that we were constantly also navigating after the meetings was all the donors basically look like me.
Yeah. You know?
And that conversation, you know, as two people who were very forward with our experiences and we like to, you know, analyze and perhaps overanalyze everything that we just experienced, the donors always look like me. The donors very rarely look like her.
Yeah.
I mean, how, what's your thought? Where are we going to go? Where are we going? How are we going to get there? And can we get there? Are there faster paths? Are there braver paths that we maybe need to go down?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, Justin. You know, I'm really encouraged by what I've seen in our local community in Central Texas, which is this emergence of identity-based donor networks. And so many years ago, probably over 20 years ago, I was part of a group of young Latino professionals who established a giving circle called Futuro Fund. And it was a group of colleagues who came together. We were all probably mid-career level and at a place where we had a little bit of disposable income. We wanted to be more philanthropic with our dollars. We also, because of our own lived experience, felt like the sector needed support in terms of one, being more explicit about how it was serving the Latino community. We asked questions in our application, our mini grant application, around the diversity of board members as well as executive leadership. So that was over 20 years ago that this group was meeting and kind of pooling their funds together and then sharing and investing grants in the community. Since then, there have been other groups that have evolved, like the New Philanthropists, which I think you might be interviewing one of our colleagues, the executive director, Paulina Arpieda. Yes. And so Paulina and her team have been working really hard at really diversifying this pipeline of philanthropists and donors and helping them kind of navigate what you just described with your colleague when they might be one of the first board members on a board who's a person of color, or if they're, you know, coming together with philanthropists and they're maybe less than 5% of the room. And so we're really, you know, just creating a community for, again, folks to be their glorious selves, to bring their lived experience, their perspectives, and their dollars, and to and to lovingly also kind of share what our community aspirations and expectations might be as we all invest in this community.
Okay, Madge. So I know, I'm guessing we get 150 to 200 downloads on this, on the total library of this podcast every day. So we've got a lot of listeners. And there's a, let's say there's a 26-year-old Latino young woman who's decided that fundraising is and honestly, this will be the first time this question's been posed. What does she need to know about who she is and where she's at in the world to know that she's particularly well-suited for this kind of work?
You know, that's a great question.
I've had lots of people, as you simmer on this. So I've had lots of people on the show. I've had plenty of women on the show, and I've had women, Black women, for example, on the show. But I'm thinking about a conversation I had with Armando. Armando is a gentleman, an advocate for the Latino community in Los Angeles. But I got to say, you know, that's the smallest the Latino community's not been very well represented in the 300 plus episodes. And that's what he would say on the Mac, you know, when he's looking at what his critique would be is that we have so few in the Latino community doing this philanthropic work. Right. So what are you saying? What are you saying to the people that are listening to that conversation that I had with him and to the people who are listening to this conversation? Is there something that they need to know that makes them particularly well-suited?
Well, you know, Jason, I always, you know, love asking more curious questions rather than providing answers, because I do believe...
isn't the decolonizing wealth guy...
Yes, Edgar Villanueva.
Yes. I mean, he's certainly raised the... Now, but he's not on the... his conversation is sort of on the giving money away sort of
right,
angle, right? But I'm somewhat embarrassed, but this is what podcasters do. We're just not having this conversation
right,
with individuals who want to be in fundraising roles or even executive director roles like yourself.
Right.
You're rare.
Well, the curious question that I was going to mention, it, you know, for folks who are out there thinking about, gosh, you know, why don't we have enough, you know, Latino, Latina, Latinx, you know, youth or young professionals in the sector. I think the question is one for us to ask ourselves, why not? Do they not exist? I don't believe that's true, because I know that that in the past has been kind of for some, a reflection that folks have had when they're looking for executive directors or CEOs. And I know plenty who are in the seat and or interested to serve. So it's not, in my opinion, an issue of the pool. I think it's figuring out what are the conditions that are going to really invite and entice Latino or a Latina professional to go into fundraising. What are the barriers? I don't know. I mean, at least in the nonprofit sector, I just cited some of the Race to Lead research that we've been doing. I'm wondering if your sector or our sector, because, you know, as a CEO, I'm a chief fundraising officer myself, but
yes,
wondering if the fundraising environment has really gone inward to do an assessment of itself to ask what are our demographics, whether it's, you know, race, age, gender, sexual orientation, what is that disability? What does that look like? And where do we need to close those gaps? And then what do we need to do to get there? Those would be my curious questions for us to explore.
Yeah, as I'm thinking back on that conversation I had with Armando, part of what his critique was, or part of what his message was that a lot of us, a lot of the conversation, and I think we actually had a conversation about Edgar's book, is very much oriented towards the flow of money coming from large foundations, for example. And what Armando's right, trying to do is persuade individuals in the Latino community like yourself to get into leadership roles and in major gifts roles. He's a major gifts guy. And he's like, learn how to take people out to lunch, learn how to, you know, learn how to, you know, learn how to relate to people in, you know, human to human lunch table type settings, which is one of the things we're constantly talking about here on the podcast, is just being human and being, you know, just like the conversations Danielle and I had when we were meeting with donors, and not being, you know, so focused on the institutional flows. You know, there's a lot of times the criticism about the way that philanthropy works is that it comes, you know, is the institutionalized and the applications and the processes and stuff.
And I also think there's
conversations.
I think there's a lot of room for the sector, that's all of us, to also acknowledge power dynamics that are just entrenched in philanthropy and in donor, you know, donor relations, and be able to challenge those in a really loving way. There is very much a power differential. I feel it every time I go in to ask a major donor or a foundation for an investment or a gift. And as I shared, you know, in a previous life, I actually worked at a foundation, so I know the institution. I worked both at a philanthropic foundation and then a corporate banking foundation. So I understand the game. And I also acknowledge, because I worked in institutions, that there are practices, legacy, kind of white dominant practices of power and privilege that don't serve community. And so it's up to all of us working together to acknowledge when those are kind of bubbling up, and then to figure out, to your point, how do we just have a conversation and break bread together and talk about, this is a community issue we want to solve, whether it's, you know, homelessness or trying to support K-12 education, how do we all rally around it? And so, you know, Edgar Villanueva, the author of Decolonizing Wealth, also talks about the importance of trust. And he talks about how money is a tool, right, to reflect the obligations people develop to each other as they interact. So that in and of itself kind of levels the playing field. So we just need to remember that.
I remember, maybe you've had this experience either at your previous role or the one you're in now. I remember being at tables with wealthy white donors. And I knew that, the power dynamic was there for no other reason, because they were super wealthy, right? You knew that they had that. I mean, that's where the power oftentimes is. But sitting there oftentimes having a conversation with a very eloquent, smart woman like my boss, Danielle, she intimidated the hell out of some of those donors. They're just as uncomfortable as we are sometimes.
That's interesting. And that goes back to the trust piece of just basic relationship building, right?
Yeah.
Just being able to, one, bring one's full self, whether you're a woman of color or a white person, talk about what's important to you, establish that relationship. And hopefully, as that relationship is being cultivated, be able to have, you know, this really honest conversation about what might be needed, even if it means talking about power in the room, I know most folks are not used to having that conversation, especially folks who have power. Like even me as a CEO, as a woman of color CEO, I've been trying to be more mindful and self-aware of the positional power I hold, you know, even within my own organization, as I'm, you know, working with my teammates and staff. I think about it also when I'm out in the community, when I'm mentoring, you know, like that's just something that that I've learned with, you know, through our work together, and my staff have taught me that the positional power is a thing as well.
Is part of the mission at Mission Capital to kind of create, is part of what we're doing here with this roadshow coming up, to kind of create that space where messiness and
It is. It's capacity building, you know, at its best, I think.
Right.
One of the things we've been trying to work on and that we do offer is just kind of creating the conditions for brave spaces. We don't call them safe spaces. It's like brave spaces, right?
Yeah.
So we can all exercise that sense of courage. So that means talking about implicit bias, that we all carry implicit bias regardless of who we are, and how, and examining when does that show up? How does that show up? We're also folding that into, for example, our consulting engagements. You know, as we're helping a board look for its next leader, you know, on the front end, we talk about implicit bias in the hiring process and recruiting and how it shows up in, you know, in the world. And that way we can help mitigate those biases and just be really mindful and set up, you know, systems and processes for calling people in if we feel like, you know, we're leaning on the bias side. And in addition to kind of actually having workshops on implicit bias so that we're learning about that, we've also had workshops on just kind of the racial history of our community. So one of the offerings that we've had at Mission Capital is Austin's Compounding Racism, Structural Racism, and really understanding our history here in Central Texas and how it's evolved, why we have certain districts that were, you know, historically considered, you know, Latino Mexican districts or Black districts, and how economic development and has played a part in that over time. And now, you know, we have this vibrant community that everybody wants to move to, one of the best, hottest cities in Austin, yet we're still seeing this tale of two cities. And that's because of kind of the structural decisions, the systemic decisions that were race-based that were made. And so now we're grappling with how do we create community solutions, acknowledging our history, but reimagining the future.
Going back to your original question, And just kind of reflecting on the myriad of, again, going back to this idea of this high, these higher aspirations that I think a lot of us within the fundraising space are talking about. One of the things that I think is sort of consistently there in the conversation is that fundraisers are going to have to become increasingly courageous and confident, brave, to use your word, brave, about being willing to drive the conversation. That's kind of the, you know, and I think back to the original question that you posed, the idea, well, what if we began to design and organizations started to more reflect the actual communities that they serve? Organizations, when it comes to their donors, are going to have to have the courage to drive the conversation. I, as a white guy who've sat across the table for my entire career from white people, could, for the most part, drive the conversation because my privilege allows me to do that. Mm-hmm. But whoever's on the receiving side, you know, I'm interested in your reflection on that thought that whoever's on the receiving side, on our side of the table, is going to have to conjure up the courage to drive the conversation, perhaps in ways that historically some of this donor-centered wonky-wonk. Mm-hmm. This isn't about customer service. I had a gal on here one time, Madge, say, you know, her job was to be a concierge for the rich and famous. And I thought, that's bullshit. That's not your job. You know? And she was as white as I am. But so this had nothing to do with, you know, this was not a BIPOC conversation. But, you know what I'm saying? Do you follow
where I'm at
there?
I do.
You've got to have the nerve to drive this thing in some
ways. And that's why I'm really also encouraged about some of these other emergent groups that, for example, our board member, Michelle Flores-Vrin, is a part of, this community-centric fundraising. Yes, and so it's national. We have a Texas chapter. Michelle's part of our Texas group, and we're doing in Central Texas. So there is this really incredible pivot happening in fundraising around how do we get back to community and mission focus and have it not be about the donor. Because although we do appreciate donors and philanthropic funders and their investments, it's all about the mission and the work. And we all just need to remember why we're here.
Yeah. Yeah. This writing project that all my listeners or any of my regular listeners have been hearing about, we've got to figure out how to, you know, get the donor to the table, and they've got to feel safe and comfortable and all that sort of stuff. But I think so much of fundraising is premised on consumer logic, the idea that the customer is king, et cetera, which is completely bad theory for what we do in the nonprofit sector. And I think some of the work that our friends at CCF and others are trying to do is we're trying to basically unravel a century's worth of expertise that says, you know, the donor's a, you know, a fair partner at the table, and I use the word citizen. They're a citizen, a member of the community, but they're not the king and they're not the customer, you know.
Right. The community's the customer. How beautiful is that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just flip the switch. Yep.
When I was in my job in college, I'm reminded when these conversations happen, you know, when I was in college, I worked at Sears and, you know, the customer was always right.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I've thought through that these last couple of years, I thought, how many of us in this fundraising space, whoever we happen to be, have sort of bought into that idea that the customer is always right and sort of applied it to our fundraising practices. And I don't think, imagine, tell me if you agree with me on this. I don't think our donors come to the lunch table nearly as often with an awareness or I don't think they know where the hell they want to go with their charitable giving. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Well, and that's why our job is really important, right? As nonprofit leaders who are hopefully, you know, rooted in community, in relationship with community, we can be a guide to share with donors and other, you know, philanthropic funders and investors where they can support the work. But that's part of our job. To work in tandem with folks.
Madge, it has certainly been a pleasure to have this conversation here today. You and I are going to have the pleasure of enjoying lunch together here in a couple of weeks when
yes.
I'm in town. We're going to be hosting. Tell us a little bit. So the event is being hosted Friday,
September 16th.
Yeah. Give the specifics if you don't mind, so that because you know exactly where we're going
to
be.
Absolutely, Jason. We're so excited to welcome you all and co-host you in Austin on Friday, September 16th. And that will be at Mobile Loaves and Fishes, one of our nonprofit community partners here in town that's doing amazing work in helping to provide transitional housing for the unhoused. They've got a beautiful campus in East Austin, and will be receiving us there to learn more about this important topic, how we can all be responsive with fundraising and through our nonprofit work.
Madge, it has certainly been a pleasure. I look forward to being with you in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, have a wonderful afternoon, and you're always welcome back.
Thank you. Take care, Jason. It's been a pleasure.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.